And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Reporter. We got a treat for you. You all know this man by reputation, by name, and I'm sure you've seen his great work as an independent media citizen journalist, whatever you want to call him, just a tremendous researcher. His name, of course, James Corbett, the Corbett Report or CorbettReport.com. And I just want to introduce him by way of this very quickly. You know, a big issue over the last couple of months has been Pizzagate. If you go back and if you look at the Corbett Report at CorbettReport.com, it's two T's. In fact, the link is in the program description. But if you look at his work, at the investigative work product that he's done along with Sybil Edmonds, Wayne Madsen, and others, you will see that James Corbett, our guest right now, had been investigating this and had been identifying this and offering a great, rich investigative work product long before the word Pizzagate was ever known, and just uncovering and exposing the evil and deeds of darkness. This guy, to me, is the real deal. I like him a lot. James Corbett, Joe, I'm going to kick it to you. You can bring him on.
Yeah, well, I want to just comment on one of the better YouTube videos I've ever seen, which Mr. Corbett created was the Conspiracy of 9/11 in 5 minutes.
9/11, the conspiracy theory.
9/11, a conspiracy theory. Folks, if you have not watched this video, it's five and a half minutes long. It is very good, and I've been following ever since I saw that video, and it's great to have you on the show, Mr. Corbett.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
And folks, I want to tell you, Mr. Corbett is traveling. He's making so gracious, because he's actually talking to us from Japan, where it's 9:30 in the morning. Over there in Japan, we've got a lot of listeners over in Japan as well. So I appreciate you joining us
well, to be clear, I'm not traveling. I live here.
Why didn't I know that? I'm sorry.
I don't know.
I'm sorry. I thought you were. Okay. I apologize. That's right. You know what? Never mind. I'm going to blame it on age. Well, regardless, let's get into content. Your work that you've done is tremendous. Here we are, day three of the Trump presidency. Mr. Corbett, what are you focused on right now? What do you think? What's your kind of assessment of the landscape the American landscape?
Well, to be fair, I come at this as an outsider. Obviously, I'm a Canadian. I live in Japan, so I can only view it from afar. But from this distance, it certainly looks chaotic, I think would be the word to use. No matter which side of whichever spectrum you might be on and whether or not you support this Trump presidency or not, I think everyone can agree that things are in chaos right now. And I argue that it's a generated chaos. In fact, I just wrote an article about this for the International Forecast, Chaos Out of Order. Because we've all heard of order out of chaos, the 33rd degree Freemason dictum, ordo ab chao, to bring a new order. You know, you use chaos as a way to get people to want the new order. Well, in order to get people to that point, you have to generate the chaos. And I think we're in a position of generated chaos right now. And that's part of what's happening right now. So we're seeing the complete meltdown of the international monetary order, the international financial order, the international political security order, and then domestically also breakdown of societal order, all happening at the same time. And it's, I don't know about what your perception of it is, but certainly where I'm sitting, things are getting crazier and crazier, and the craziness is actually increasing. The acceleration is happening right now. So I think this is all towards the installation of a new order. And you can't bring in a new order without getting rid of the old order. And that means all of the old verities and pieties of the previous order have to go, including Pax Americana, including the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, including all of these things that we've just taken as the base way of understanding the world for our entire lifetimes are starting to be chipped away at right now. And it's a very worrying thing, but it can be a positive thing, because certainly we do, I think, want to transition off away from this old order. But we don't want the new world order that they're trying to bring in as a result of it. So it is, it's a time when everything that we think we know is liquefying, and that can be very freeing, but it can also mean that there's a new order that they're going to try to impose very soon.
Yeah, we totally agree. And yeah, that's been a subject of ours for quite some time. Now, you've done so much great investigative work about so many things, it's hard to like pin anything down.
I got a first question based on what you said, James. The populist movement and the election of Donald Trump, is this a continuation of the globalist plan, or is this something that came out of left field from your analysis?
Well, I don't subscribe to the grand unified conspiracy theory that everything is controlled by a couple of men in a room. I think there are certainly forces who have a great degree of control over what's happening, but I don't think they control everything down to the micro level. But they can certainly play off of societal factors. In fact, I think that's the primary way that people in positions of power do maintain and leverage their power, is by playing on things that are already happening and things that they can already use that really do exist that they can leverage. So if there is a reaction against the sort of globalism that they've been shoving down everyone's throat for the last few decades, then they'll try to find a way to use that reaction to their benefit. And again, it's not that there's one single power that directs all of this. I think there are different cliques that war with each other to a certain extent, but they of course all want control of, America Inc. or the World Order Inc. So they're all, none of them want to upset the apple cart, but they all want to have control over that apple cart. So they might war with each other. So for example, we see Kissinger meeting personally with Trump on multiple occasions and coming out just a couple of weeks ago to say, hey, guys, guess what? Don't expect Trump to follow through on all his campaign promises. I've been talking to him and I think, he's getting up to speed on things. So we can see that some of the old cliques are circling around, and whatever kind of drain the swamp campaign rhetoric was being used was jettisoned immediately upon the election when Trump said, the Clintons are a great family. I'd love to take advice from them and all this sort of thing. So I think Trump supporters are going to be deeply disappointed, assuming that they face the reality of what's happening. It doesn't mean that all is for naught, because I think the idea, the base of this, the political populism that you identify there, is a real phenomenon. And there are good aspects to that. There needs to be a revolt against the order that they've been trying to impose on the world for the last few decades. It's just a question of who directs that and in what way that energy gets released. And if it gets all shunted back into federal, national politics, and everyone, let's all rally around the flag and rally around this president no matter what he does, then it will all have been for naught. But I think there's at least a chance to use this energy, and if we direct it in the right way towards the right topics, towards people actually taking matters back into their own hands, their own life, finding ways to organize with each other in communities rather than looking to some political messiah to come down from on high in Washington, D.C. If we can do that, I think there is a chance to use this moment of kickback, of revolt, in a positive way.
You mentioned, the continuing push of this new world order to continue to disrupt our economy, taking the world off the world reserve currency, taking the U.S. dollar off the world reserve currency status, continuing their push in any way, in any area they can achieve it. What do we expect to see with this continued growing political divide in this country amongst the citizens? It seems like from the Obama administration, the divide really started. He continued to push it and not address it and not unify the country, not attempt to unify the country. Now we have what seems to be capitalists versus communists, anarchists versus conservatives. And it seems like the rhetoric's getting more intense and violent. The actions are becoming more violent. Do you see this trend continuing throughout the near future?
Well, I wish I didn't. But unfortunately, this is a process that feeds on itself, and it's very difficult to put the brakes on once the ball gets rolling. And the ball is definitely rolling, as you point out. I mean, every single possible divide is being played onto the maximum now, black and white, and the difference between the sexes and sexual orientation, and all of this is being pushed on. And the divide, the wedge, is being driven further and further between people. So that people, of course, identify their neighbor as the source of their problems rather than, the institutions which have been put into place to rule over them. And that is the fundamental problem. It's been the fundamental problem throughout the entirety of human civilization. Divide and conquer is a very, 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 very old principle that's been well established and well understood for thousands of years. And think of how much more refined that technique has become than it was, say, a couple of thousand years ago when it was first being worked out. So I think it's not an easy thing to even unless it is explicitly identified and understood for what it is, it's extremely difficult to put the brakes on, because certainly when someone pushes the extreme, you feel compelled as a human being to want to go the other way, to resist against that. That's the obvious thing. So when people are pushing some obvious agenda down your throat about some ridiculous political correctness and pronouns and things and what you can and cannot say, as people know from Jordan Peterson's work in Canada, they're now trying to outlaw certain pronouns that can or cannot be used in the classroom and things like this. When people push kind of extremist nonsense down people's throats like that, the natural reaction is, okay, let's push against that. And that's where people's energies and time and attention gets directed. And so what is the answer to that? The answer has to be stepping out of that. Clearly, people are being pushed into a dialectic. Choose this side or choose that side, but just choose a team and war with each other. And there has to be a way of finding, once again, community. I keep coming back to this because I keep thinking of things, the situation we're in right now. I think there is parallels between the ways that the great powers are aligning themselves right now and the way they were in the run-up to World War I, which is quite worrying. But economically and financially, there are parallels with the Great Depression era, the Great Recession era of the late 20s, early 30s. And in that time, especially in the United States, think about how rural a society it still was. There still were communities at that point. Think about that being transplanted into 2017. And think about the way that community would break down in an instant if there was a serious and fundamental disruption of the economic order. And that worries me, because we're already seeing chaos and violence and people at each other's throats. Throw in a little bit of economic chaos, and I don't know if there's a way to stop the civil war at that point. So I think the real focus has to be in the creation of community now, while there's still the opportunity to do so, so that those community structures will see people through the turbulent times that are absolutely coming.
No, I agree with you 100%. That's something we talk about in the show a lot. In any type of societal collapse, whether it's economic or just a civil collapse, it will only people who band together and form these communities will be, in my opinion, the only chance to survive these things. You're not going to be able to do it alone. You need people with different areas of expertise. You need people working together to accomplish many things. And without that, just on survival alone, you know, the odds are astronomically stacked against any individual or pair of people who try to do that.
Well, if I can jump in here, James, if I can ask you a question here. Obviously, you talk a lot, and folks, our guest is James Corbett, the Corbett Report, open source intelligence news. His website, CorbettReport.com, with two T's, linked off of HagmanReport.com, also in the program description. And I would highly recommend, of course, supporting James's work, and please support via his button there, support his work via Patreon. Right there, you can click on the button and, of course, do that. But James, of all of the threats facing Americans today, from your perch outside of the country, what do you see as the biggest threat internally? You mentioned economic. You mentioned, of course, the number of things. But what do you see taking place here? What will fracture first, in your view, based on your recent research?
That's a good question. I understand why you ask it, but I don't know if it's answerable, because all of them are so thoroughly intermixed that really, I mean, no matter whether the disruption comes through economic disruption or monetary disruption or some sort of societal disruption, some sort of, you know, riots of, you know, left and versus right or whatever it is, or whether it comes from some sort of international incident, I'm not sure that the first domino to fall it's particularly necessary to identify which one that will be, because as soon as it falls, I think the others will fall with it in rapid order. And we also have to keep in mind that the powers that shouldn't be always love to blame economic disruption on some foreign boogeyman in order to launch wars. This has happened throughout history. So I think, again, no matter what happens, it will all happen in short order. And that, again, it's very worrying because I do see the parallels leading up to what we saw in 1914. And it's very difficult to imagine a way forward from here that does not result in some form of warfare. But what warfare actually looks like in this day and age is really the big question, because I can't imagine it will look anything like what we saw in previous wars. It will have to be something completely different and will probably be more obviously based on cyber warfare or financial warfare, trade warfare, which can be equally, if not even more, devastating in the long run, especially to civilian populations. Think about how far we are removed from the idea in, say, 18th century warfare, where people would go and take a picnic to watch a battlefield because, you know, as a civilian bystander watching from a few miles distance, you're fine. And it's just two armies battling on a warfield. Think about World War One, World War Two. Suddenly civilians are being bombed and it's coming home. Now think in this current era where cyber warfare takes place and cyber terrorists or whatever are taking down electrical grids. Suddenly it is primarily civilian populations that are affected. So that's my particular biggest worry, I think. But again, in terms of which disruption comes first, I think I'm not even sure that's necessarily important. I certainly do have my eye on the economic disruptions that are very, very possible, because I think that's one of the easiest and most straightforward levers of control of the old power elite. I mean, even if we were to take Trump seriously as a true and genuine independent threat to the establishment, this billionaire who has come down to, you know, lead the country into promised land of milk and honey, still the Federal Reserve has an incredible amount of control over the economy, not only of the United States, but the entire world. And if they start jacking up rates too quickly, they can absolutely suck the money out of the swamp, all of the heroin basically that they've spiked in the punch bowl over the last 8-9 years can be drawn up very quickly, and it can cause the type of economic disruption that no Trump or anyone else would be able to do anything about if they get that ball rolling. So again, unfortunately, it's extremely easy to create chaos, and they're always trying to position themselves to benefit from that chaos.
You're absolutely right. James, if we can kind of switch gears here, I want to talk about the media. Now, I know, you said you were in Japan, and do you see a lot of U.S. media? Do you make it a point to see it?
I pretty much only watch online media. We have a television. We don't have it even hooked up. So we don't really consume media in any other way. So what I watch is primarily American, Canadian, other types of English language media.
And you've obviously seen the mainstream media's coverage of Trump, and the reason I ask is because I wanted to get your opinion on, after he gave his inauguration speech, the Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews said it was a dark and militant speech. They called it Hitlerian. Just the attacks that are feeding into this political divide that we talked about earlier. And I wanted to know how that differs from Japan and what perception you guys are getting there, as opposed to what's being told to the people here in the U.S.
So just to be clear, that's the same Chris Matthews who got the thrill up his leg when he saw Obama speak 8 years ago, right?
Yep.
Yeah. How does it differ from Japanese media? The Japanese societal context is so completely different because Japan was called by one of the administrators of the American administration here after World War II as a nation of children. And unfortunately, to a certain extent, there is something to that. It is very much a society where people are told what to do and generally will go along with it. And that means that there is a lot less societal friction here. There, you don't see a lot of riots and protests and police state kind of goons jumping around with their jackboots or anything. It's a much, much safer, I suppose, in that sense. But of course, it does mean that people are easily, if not easily indoctrinated, at least will go along with whatever is societally expected. And that creates a situation where people, still, There seems to be a lot of naive trust and faith in a lot of the media here. And to the extent that people disbelieve what they're seeing in the media here, they'll generally keep that to themselves. So it's a very different context, but it does mean that certain narratives can be pushed quite a lot more easily than they can be pushed in a place with a more independent mindset like the United States, where at least people understand that they're getting a certain line, they're getting a certain view. When you tune into Rachel Maddow, you know what you're going to get. Whereas in Japan, I think people just assume that there is some sort of objective viewpoint that people can report from.
And the reason I wanted to get into the media is something you said earlier about the New World Order agenda, the globalist agenda that piggybacks off of real events, real things that are happening. And it's not so much a, you know, top down conspiracy controlled by, you know, one mind or one person. And the reason I wanted to ask that is because here there's just been a huge disconnect. It seems like many in the mainstream media have just completely stopped objectively reporting facts and now bring you the news with their own or their producer or writer's own twisted ideology into it. And it seems to be a growing trend that's just happened as of late since the fake news narrative came out and since so many people came against Trump with either lies or what they perceived to be the truth. And there was some fact in there from Trump's own comments, but I mean, it just seems like everything's being made up and then that made up story's being given to the people, being given to news reporters to the point where it's almost like they believe it themselves to be true, regardless of the facts that are given. And I just wanted to kind of get an idea of what the international perception right. of Trump was.
Well, you identify an important point there because we are absolutely of the many transitions that we're undergoing. One of them is a fundamental transition in the nature of the media and people's relation to it. And in previous generations, people would look to a Walter Cronkite or whatever to tell them that's the way it was. And people would generally would take that as the daily news. Of course, we can't do that in today's context, even if we wanted to, because it has become so polarized, so obviously propagandistic. Now, that's a transition, I think, that's taking place in people's understanding of what media is and how it functions. And I think it is necessary. We're going from the naive belief that there is some sort of objective viewpoint that some angel on the clouds is going to report the daily news from. Whereas, of course, we now know, for example, I mean, on Walter Cronkite specifically, he was a committed globalist who said, if that makes me a devil, then I'm happy to sit on the right hand of Satan. Ha ha ha. And things like this. I mean, that comes out, you know, decades later at the end of this person's lifetime when people have been listening to them as some sort of objective news point for their whole life or, you know, being the voice of the owl in Bohemian Grove and the crazy rituals that go on there. So we have to understand that there is no objective viewpoint. Even choosing what is or is not worthy to talk about on the news is itself coming from an ideological perspective. Now, unfortunately, people, I think, still believe in the idea of objectivity of media, but we're seeing this hyper-subjectivization of it, this hyper-partisan nature of reporting that's coming along. And so people are still caught in the mindset, okay, well, everything that comes from the media is true, except for those liars out there, those ones on the other side of the political spectrum from me, they're liars. The ones that I see are telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And so it creates this hyper-partisanship within the society itself. Whereas I think what we need to do is break down that barrier and realize that everything that you are seeing is coming from an ideological perspective. And once you understand that, then you can separate out the facts that are being talked about from the perspective that those facts are being nested inside. And once you do that, I think people can have a more healthy relationship to whatever media is. But unfortunately, again, just because of the technological advances that have been made, media has been becoming more and more ever present in people's lives, intruding into people's innermost thoughts, to the point where people find it difficult these days to go outside the house without something plugged into their ears to listen to. It's everywhere and always and constantly the voice in our ear. And that's worrying because, of course, that is the primary way that propaganda can be inserted. And we are losing that space within our own minds just to have quiet contemplation that would have been the norm even a couple of generations ago.
James, we got about a minute and a half before the break. After the break, I got some questions talking about the trade deals and the a few other things. Can you talk about, we'll start here and pick up here on the other side, the what your latest episode, Obama, A Legacy in the Ashes?
Yes. Well, Obama, what can you say about Obama that hasn't been said, except for the, yes, what I wanted to point out in that episode of my podcast was not just the lies themselves and the hypocrisy, which again is pretty easy to point out, but what it really means underlying the sort of Obama himself. I wanted to point out that it wasn't Obama as a person individually that was the source and font of all evil in the United States. It was what he represented and the interests that he fronted for. And since we now know through leaked emails that, oh yeah, the head of Citigroup actually picked his entire cabinet before he was even in office. He had it all picked out and he chose from the list that Citigroup provided for him to pick his cabinet. That shows you something more fundamental about the way power operates at the highest levels than we elected a president and now the president will lead us. That is the naive point of view.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And unfortunately, you know, what Trump brought to the table and the movement that got behind him, I do agree with. At the same time, I'm very hesitant. And many people seem to have just let go and accepted that Trump's the new president and everything's going to be, you know, great and rainbows and unicorns. Well,
we're being played in so many levels, you know.
Right. And people have let their guard down. And I think that's a dangerous place to be in. But when we come back, folks, you're listening to James Corbett at CorbettReport.com, as well as James Corbett or Corbett Report on YouTube also. He'll be with us for the next segment. So when we come back, we're going to pick up right where we left off. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And we are talking with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com, Corbett Report on YouTube. Before the break, we were talking about Obama. You have a post on your website and on YouTube, A Legacy of Ashes. And before the break, you were talking about how it wasn't that Obama was evil, that it was what he, his ideology, what he believed was evil. And you talked about the control behind the Citibank picking his cabinet positions. How much of the Obama administration decisions were his own versus how many do you think were made for him already?
That's a very good question. I would imagine very few of them were Obama's own. And I think the vast majority of them came from those that he was connected to and connected with. And there are, I think, in any administration, there are centers of power. And I think that varies from administration to administration. I think it's quite obvious in the Bush era that it was not George W. Bush running the country. If anything, it was his vice president, Dick Cheney, who had much more control over that administration. In the same way, I think in the Reagan era, it was not that power was very much in the presidential office. It was in the vice presidential office of George H.W. Bush. And that he was running things like Iran-Contra. And I'm sure Reagan really wasn't involved in the nitty-gritty of that. I'm pretty sure he didn't get his fingers dirty in all of that. I think that was George H.W. Bush running that. So in the Obama era, I think the history is still yet to be written and parsed. But I would imagine that it's more in places like when Secretary of State Clinton was in the State Department. I'm sure that she had a lot of control over shaping the policy in Libya, for example, in Syria in its early stages. Or, for example, Victoria Nuland in the State Department helping to puppeteer what the Maidan coup in the Ukraine, bringing the fascists into power there. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to uncover who was behind which particular policies and in what way they were advocated. But the idea that Obama was ruling over all of this, I think, is the most naive view of all. And I think the point really in creating, especially, I mean, of course, we're looking back at the Obama era because it's the end of the Obama era. So we need to understand that legacy. But I think, as always, the history is what's important. Can we learn from that for today? And it's important to look back at the crowds from 2008. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Chanting in hypnotic union at the rapture of this messiah that was being called a messiah and Superman, and he came from Krypton and all of this kind of nonsense that was floating around in the atmosphere at that time, to see how powerful a delusion hope and change can be, and how powerfully he tapped into that with his campaign slogans and all of that. The iconography was there to make him into something that he was not, this messiah that was going to save people. And now I see it happening from the opposite perspective. I see it happening with Trump and people investing their identity in Trump. I get it. He says things that appeal to people and things that are good and things that go against the globalists. And look, the CIA is attacking him, all of this. Therefore, it means he's good. I just hope that people can look at the way that delusion has worked in the past and understand that it still has an effect on people today. And to use that to at least, I mean, hey, don't believe James Corbett. Who is he? He's a nobody in Japan. What does he know about American politics? Fine, don't believe me. But just reserve a tiny place in your heart that you do not give over to identifying in the rapture of this new political messiah. Just reserve a tiny little bit of skepticism, a place for you to at least stand apart from that, so that you don't give your identity over to it. Because once you do that, then you go along with anything that comes along. And I think if you fall for anything, you'll stand for nothing. And I think that's the exact opposite of the place we want to be in.
I think you're exactly right. I believe everybody needs to have a healthy skepticism of any administration, since we've seen throughout history how the president, the office of the president, is used to continue to further the globalist and New World Order agenda. And there's no reason to believe that it has been stopped dead in its tracks right now. I just believe that there's areas that Trump will be able to come out and harp on against. But at the same time, like you mentioned with the Federal Reserve, there will be areas that are under the radar behind the scenes that they will, you know, move 10 steps forward with. And then when they get their other person in place, or if they need to, then they can go back and work on the things that they couldn't do right now. Which brings me to our next point. We have two issues going on right now. The executive order Trump signed to get the U.S. out of the TPP, and what that means to countries on the Pacific Rim, Asian Pacific Rim, and U.S.-China relations under Trump and the threat of war. If we can, let's start with the TPP.
Yes, a very interesting move, and obviously one that I think is for the best, because the TPP was a monstrosity crafted and created behind closed doors in unprecedented secrecy. Not just secrecy, but total secrecy, to the point where even congressmen could not look at the bill as it was being drafted and negotiated. They had to go into a secret room in the bowels of the Congress, and, you know, they couldn't even take a notepad with them and all of this kind of nonsense, let alone the secrecy that was surrounding all of the different negotiation meetings where they had, you know, helicopters and people with guns on the roof and all of this trying to make sure that nobody penetrated the secrecy of this agreement. And then when it was finally released, of course, it was hundreds and hundreds of pages of total nonsense, legalese, gibberish. But if you could sort your way through even a few of the clauses, you would see that it was, again, a complete monstrosity that was created by and for the corporate oligarchs to maintain their essentially monopolistic control over international trade. A free trade policy could be written on the back of a cocktail napkin. No, you don't put tariffs on our goods. We won't put tariffs on yours. There you go. But no, of course, that's not what this is. It's about exceptionally controlled trade so that only the crony oligarchs could get involved in it. So scrapping the TPP is a great thing, I think, ultimately. But it's interesting to see the way that this will play out and what will happen as a result of the vacuum that's been created. Last December, just last month, the Japanese parliament, the Diet, actually ratified the TPP, which is extremely odd because with the U.S. out, it is a dead agreement. The TPP as written has to be ratified by all members, including, of course, the United States. So it is officially dead now that they're pulling out. But Japan ratified it anyway, which is odd, unless we see that as a portent of things to come, perhaps the creation of an alternate TPP without the U.S. All right, they won't join it. Well, who will? And guess who's stepping into the void? China. In November, Zero Hedge was reporting, with TPP dead, China officially launches its own Pacific free trade deal. So the ultimate effect of this might be, if this really is an America First administration and they really do step away from these types of agreements, well, someone's going to fill in that void in terms of the power relations in the Asia Pacific, and it's probably going to be China. And although that would have seemed almost unthinkable even a few years ago when there was active and open squabbles going on in, for example, the South China Sea, where, of course, there's still territorial disputes and what have you. But now we have the president, the new president of the Philippines, Duterte, is saying that China is the better, you know, they want to partner up with China and, you know, to hell with the U.S. and all this kind of rhetoric that's coming from Duterte. And then also we have even Australia saying, well, look, I mean, our interests are more served with going with China. And you have important people in the Australian governments starting to talk that way. So there really is a change that's taking place here. Barring some sort of drastic move, I don't think it'll happen overnight. But still, I think we're going to see China stepping up more and more. And that will be a very interesting transition to make. As I've also documented, I did a podcast on China and the New World Order that showed that the rise of China over the last 15, 20 years as an economic powerhouse did not happen out of the blue or naturally or spontaneously. It's been a coordinated effort over the last four decades by the Rockefellers and their ilk, Kissinger yep. and Brzezinski and all of them, to try to make China into this superpower. So I don't think they're free from all of this game anyway, but at any rate, it'll be a different looking Asia Pacific.
Yeah. And you mentioned the rise of China, Kissinger, Brzezinski, and so many others. Rockefeller wrote about the rise of Asia and the Asian markets decades ago, and how, you know, the U.S., with their superpower being the only superpower after the 90s, it was time to, they didn't come out and just say create a new enemy, but they talked about, you know, the emerging Asian market and how it could be better served for their interests here if they built that up to have another strong economy. And we just saw at the World Economic Summit just a few weeks back, the president of China talked about, you know, if Trump's going to continue to do the America First thing, the nationalist thing, that he would step up and his country would step up to fill the globalist role, if you will. And apparently following suit with, you know, seeing these countries and China step up and say, we'll take the TPP agreement or a similar agreement. If we can, let's talk about and you mentioned the China U.S. relations. You know, Trump came out today, and we've seen this big dust up over the islands.
The one China policy.
Yeah, there's a few things that the China and the U.S. seem to be butting heads on. It seemed to be starting in the Obama administration, and now with Trump, you see the Chinese government ban the inauguration streams. You know, you couldn't talk about the inauguration. You couldn't stream the inauguration. Many said it was because they weren't sure where Trump is and how U.S.-China relations would continue. Do you expect conflict, military conflict, between the U.S. and China over some of the things that we seem to be butting heads over right now?
Right. Maybe it's wishful thinking of a sort on my part, but I don't see military confrontation as being what is ultimately what would be best for these powers that shouldn't be and what they want anyway. I think what they want, from everything that I can see from the outside, it looks like they're trying to set up the 21st century equivalent of the Cold War, the 20th century Cold War. And in that context, just like the Soviet Union was largely a paper tiger built up by lend lease and technology transfers and other things that facilitated and made the Soviet Union what it was, came from the West. And that's been amply documented by Anthony Sutton and other researchers. I think in the same way, we have to see China in that context. It's a largely paper dragon that's been constructed by the West to fill that boogeyman role in a lot of different ways. So I think that seems to me the direction they want to take this in, which means that I don't think they are looking to actually go into hot military conflict. And even if they did, I mean, China is certainly growing in terms of its capabilities, but it's still, if it came to outright open naval warfare, there's no chance they would stand if more than batting of an eyelid against the U.S. Navy at this point. So I don't think that serves anyone's interests. The growing tension, however, serves everyone's interests. It rallies all of the domestic populations around the flags, and it creates the never-ending need for more and more of the toys for big boys that the military contractors are more than happy to provide at the cost of billions and billions of dollars. So we've seen, for example, military expenditures in the Asia Pacific region increasing in recent years, and no sign that that trend's going to die down in the Trump era. So I think you're right to pick up on the rising tensions. I think that, I think that is going to be one of the, I think that's where they want to try to take the Trump administration. All this Russian boogeyman stuff is craziness and easily demonstrable propaganda, and I think will be brushed under the rug in the coming months. But I think the coming along to take that place will be the Chinese boogeyman. And we see that in terms of course, Trump accepting the phone call from the president of Taiwan, breaking decades of diplomatic protocol, breaking the U.S. agreement on one China policy that everyone says, okay, there's one China. We just won't say, you know, what that means and who controls it, but we'll just, it's one China and we won't rock that boat. Well, it looks like Trump is getting ready to rock that boat. And as you say, there's also disputes in the South China Sea in terms of islands, man-made artificial islands that China has constructed and is ready to militarize, that Rex Tillerson in his confirmation hearings for Secretary of State, which he incidentally has just been approved for, he mentioned the idea that they will block access to those islands to China, which means a naval blockade, which means outright military confrontation. So either he was misspeaking or was speaking off the cuff in the fifth hour of rather grueling testimony, or they are really truly talking about going into hot naval warfare. Again, I don't think that's where that would serve anyone's interests at this point. So I'm not looking at that as the imminent possibility, but trade warfare certainly is a possibility. And it'll be interesting to see the way this plays out, because as I say, Kissinger clearly meeting with Trump, clearly has the president's ear. Kissinger, also the person who literally wrote the book on China and about the China's role in the New World Order and all of this, and his intimate part in helping construct that as a Rockefeller minion. It's getting crazy, but I think that clearly we can see that China is going to step into that boogeyman role, whether they like it or not.
That's very well put, and a great breakdown of what's happening. And I agree that, you know, the boogeyman aspect of China, the one part that concerns me, and I want to ask you if you had to guess or make a prediction here. Do you see, we talked about the possibility for the U.S. economy to collapse and the American currency being taken off as the world reserve currency. Is that more plausible than a war with China, is to see the switch from America as the world reserve currency, if there was an economic situation, transfer that to China? I guess the question is, if America were to fall as the world reserve currency, would China be the one to pick that up?
I think it would be a multilateral move rather than a unilateral move. And I think China is specifically positioned itself for that. For the last 8 years now, the Chinese, the People's Bank of China governor has been openly advocating for the IMF's special drawing rights to become the world reserve currency. And people have probably heard about the SDR, at least in passing, but it is essentially, it's not a currency per se. It's a type of claim on currency that central banks can use. Instead of holding dollars in their reserve accounts, they can hold these SDRs and they can redeem them in any of previously four, now five currencies. It was the US dollar and the euro and the yen and whichever one I'm forgetting off the top of my head. Major world currency, the British pound, of course. And just last October, the Chinese yuan was added to that basket after years of trying to campaign to get added to the basket. They were finally added to that basket. So now China has a seat at the table, as it were. And that's the thing that bugs me most about this, because there are people who look at China and Russia as these bulwarks against the NATO powers, and they're fighting against these globalists. Well, in a sense, but what are they fighting for? And when you look at it, it's always they're fighting for, well, we want a seat at the IMF table, or we want to create this alternate to the World Bank IMF system, and it'll be this, you know, this BRICS, or it will be the new BRICS Bank, or the Asian Development, or the AIIB, or these types of things. And they're always run by people who are sometimes literally ex-IMF or ex-World Bank members. It's always the same people, and they're always trying to create these multilateral institutions that are basically just mirror images of the ones they're trying to replace and fighting against, so that no matter which side of the phony dialectic you're on, you're still going to get multilateral regional government of some sort or other. And I think that's the logic of this. So when and if the U.S. dollar does lose its reserve currency status, world reserve currency, it will be replaced more than likely by a type of basket currency that's overseen by an institution like the IMF, which isn't, I mean, it's certainly no better for the average person. It's just going to be a different system of multilateral control. In fact, in some ways, even more distant from the average American, because at least you have some theoretical kind of interaction with the American government, what interaction do you have with the IMF? What role do you say over, you know, what will happen with the pound or the yen or the euro? It just becomes this completely diffuse thing, which of course is tightly managed and controlled by very, very few people over whom you have no control. So it's getting crazier, but people are walking into it because it seems like, oh, they're fighting against the NATO and U.S., you know, American Empire kind of system. And I think it's just a false dialectic.
Yeah, it's what you said about how they what are they fighting against? What are they fighting for? It's interesting to look and see, you know, like you said, the mirror images of each other, almost like they want the same future that we have, and that's where they seem to want to go. On your website, and again, folks, Corbett Report. I'm sorry.
See, you did that again.
I apologize.
James, we were doing that all day, and we apologize.
Yeah. Interview 1245, you talk about the India demonetization disaster. This is something we talked about on our show here, about how they went about banning cash in India and how that was originated in Washington, D.C. And will that, or something like that, a cashless society happen here in the U.S.? Can you explain to us what's going on in India now?
Very, very insightful. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, to be clear, it's not a ban on cash per se. What they did was they took the 500 rupee note and the 1000 rupee note, and they said, as of midnight tonight, on the night that they announced this, it's going to be no longer legal tender. Over the next couple of months, you'll have a couple of months grace period to cash in your old notes and get new ones. So they've issued and they're printing new currency to replace that, those old notes. And the idea here is probably much like in the United States and elsewhere, people keep a certain amount of cash that is off the table and they use it for their informal economy, black market, whatever you want to call it. Which is a substantial part of the Indian economy, because, of course, a lot of people are some of the poorest people on the planet who don't use banks and aren't a part of the banking system. All of this money is not purview to the government and the taxation and all of this. So they've made this big stink about black money in the Indian economy, as they call it, which is basically just untaxed money. And so in order to combat this problem and all of the corruption that comes with it, well, let's do this and we'll call in all the notes. So everyone has to go to the bank and trade it in for new notes. So now the government knows under your name that you have this much money. And so that's what this was about. And this is important. 500 and 1000 rupee notes make up something like 80% of the value of cash in the Indian economy. And the Indian economy is something like 97-98% cash based. So it's a substantial amount of the Indian economy is going to have to travel through the banks over the coming months, and has created a lot of chaos already, will continue to create chaos. Where this is going is, I think, towards facilitating, if not a completely cashless society, at least kickstarting putting it into hyperspeed, the process of putting India into a more cashless system, cashless payment system. And you mentioned Washington's role in this. Norbert Herring has a great article on this, a well-kept open secret. Washington is behind India's brutal experiment of abolishing most cash, where he points out that just 4 weeks before this surprise announcement came, by the way, 500 to 1,000 rupee notes are no longer legal tender, U.S. aid established with the Indian finance ministry something called Catalyst, Inclusive Cashless Payment Partnership, in which they wanted to basically throw into hyper gear this transfer into a cashless payment system economy. And the CEO, for example, says Catalyst's mission is to solve multiple coordination problems that have blocked the penetration of digital payments among merchants and low-income consumers. We look forward to creating a sustainable and replicable model and a holistic ecosystem approach, and all of this kind of nonsense, feel-good, fuzzy propaganda words that they love to throw around, which is basically just the USAID helping the Indian government to go towards cashless payment systems. And I think India is once again being used, especially the poorest people in India are being used as a type of test subject. Can we transition people from completely cash-based into completely cashless? Can we do that? How do we do that? How do we get people in that? And I think, again, that program being announced 4 weeks before they start this demonetization campaign has to be significant and has to be viewed from that lens. And I do have a report up on my website called The War on War on Cash. I can't remember what it's called. Just type War on Cash into my search bar and you'll find it. And it's myself and the members of the Corporate Report community have assembled dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of stories from all around the world, literally dozens of countries, about different cashless payment systems and cashless ideas that are being promoted by various governments, literally all around the world, in every nook and cranny of the world right now. Governments are advocating for cashless payments because ultimately this is the crowning jewel in the hands of the powers that shouldn't be. The idea of complete control over the economy and micromanaging and having access to everything that goes on in that economy depends on being some sort of electronic payment system that can be monitored and controlled from a central place. And that's the economy that they want to steer us into. And it's only a question of how quickly they can do so and how best to engineer society to accept it once it comes. It's very worrying. It should be very worrying to everyone. But I think a lot of people are perhaps asleep at the switch on this issue and don't understand why it's so important. So I'm putting together a podcast right now that'll be hopefully released on my website at the end of this week, talking about India's demonetization and what it means for people around the world.
Fantastic. James Corbett, I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us tonight. Folks, go to CorbettReport.com, Corbett Report on YouTube, and bookmark his site. Help him out. Support what he's doing. He's a fantastic
journalist. Become a member, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
James, thank you so much. You have a great evening. Great day.
Thank you for having me on.